This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey, it's Jim Costa with Cash the Ticket. It's March, so Mike Valeni and I are all over the tournament again this year. There's just nothing like betting in March. Breakdowns of every region and every game. From conference tournaments to the Final Horn, we'll have the picks and the plays on every single game. Cinderella spotlights, upset alerts, and some of that value for the last team standing. It's tourney time, so hunker down and bet the board with us. Subscribe and listen to Cash the Ticket in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
7:14 now on this April 1st, April Fool's Day. Be aware of that. Aaron Holmes joins us now, Executive Director of the View Cray Property Owners, Residents, and Associates. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Doing well, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm good. Have you ever pulled any April Fool's pranks or been the victim of any?
I think I'm often the victim of them before I pull them.
One time I thought it would be funny to tell my mom years and years and years ago that my then wife was pregnant, and she started crying. She was so happy and excited, and I realized at that point that I'd made a tremendous mistake, that it was not funny. It was a stupid thing to do on April 1st, and that was probably my the worst thing that I've ever done on April 1st.
That's pretty terrible.
Well, you know what? I realize that now. Aaron, at the time, I realize that now, but at the time, I didn't. Let's talk about thanks for telling me that, though. Thanks for telling me that's pretty terrible because I haven't beat myself up enough over these years for it. Thanks, Aaron, for piling on. I'm just kidding.
Sorry, Tommy.
No, I'm just kidding. Tell me first about the meeting that happened last week about the Bourbon Street security and so forth. And was any new information gleaned from that?
Well, actually, no, but we didn't really expect any new information. So we hosted it. We actually partnered up with NOPD to host a town hall style meeting about the Bourbon Street security plan. And really what we wanted to do was get stakeholders in the room that had not gotten to talk to NOPD about some of these preliminary plans. So we didn't anticipate learning anything new. We just thought that we were going to get a little bit more information for the crowd, so to speak.
What was the meeting like, and what did you hear, and what did people have to say?
Well, it was very well attended. We thought maybe we'd get about 100 people, but it was standing room only. I think there were at least 250 people there, and it was a really good mix of residents and business owners and workers and a lot of street performers as well. So Everybody was kind of operating on concern for what they had heard. So we were really hoping that we were going to get some actionable items, but we're still waiting for the final recommendation from the consulting firm Teneo, and that information has not been made public.
I was going to ask you about that, because at first I think Freddie King had released a statement saying that it was going to be there. Then they said they weren't going to present it. Do you know when that's supposed to come out?
I don't know. I know that it has been completed, and it has been given over to the Police and Justice Foundation, which commissioned it. But from there, and in terms of who gets to see it, who gets to analyze it, how it's going to be released to the public, I don't know.
So when it comes to what the people at the meeting had to say, A, do you think it was representative of the quarter as a whole? And secondly, what were some of the things that they wanted to see or didn't want to see?
I would definitely say it was pretty representative of the diverse stakeholders that are in the French Quarter. You know, residents were very concerned that any permanent solutions, so to speak, would, you know, increase traffic or congest the traffic grid. We would lose necessary parking, access to our homes, or there'd be, you know, a concentration of larger vehicles more in the residential end, things that would have come out of, you know, maybe a 24/7 pedestrian mall or closure for Bourbon Street. Mm-hmm. And also a rumor had started, and I'm not sure the level of truth to it, that if Bourbon Street were converted into a full pedestrian mall, then they would close the Royal Street pedestrian mall, which really fired up a lot of the street performers and musicians because they use that area as a frequent busking location. And so I think it was an opportunity for the public that has not been engaged yet to get into the room to ask questions and voice concerns.
Tell me about the Royal Street Pedestrian Mall.
The Royal Street Pedestrian Mall is frequently used as street performers. So from 11 to 4 p.m. daily, it is closed to vehicular traffic. And so you'll see a lot of street performers, specifically over the corner at Rouse's. Street performers are often grouped around there, and they get larger crowds. And the pedestrian mall has been in effect for decades, really, but it was definitely during the time of COVID and also following the Hard Rock collapse. It was the hours of it were changed, and it was open most of the time, but most recently it has been closed.
And we're talking about between where and where, Aaron?
Oh, let's see. Royal Street Pedestrian Mall runs from Orleans Avenue basically through the canal. But your pedestrian mall activity is probably going to happen mostly between Royal and, say, Conti.
I got you. I was not aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there you go. Maybe I should go more often. What about the split between businesses and residents? Was there a disagreement as between those two groups, or did they see things the same?
Well, I mean, I think there was a level of disagreement between stakeholders only because different stakeholders have different needs. But I would say that what I heard were mostly that we do need to increase safety, and we need to ensure safety for, you know, everybody in the French Quarter, visitors and locals alike. But we also can't compromise what it means to be an actual neighborhood. So the businesses were saying, how do I get my deliveries? How do I get my employees to my businesses? The residents were saying, how do I maintain access to my home? And the industry workers and street performers are saying, how do I get to where I need to go to work? Mm-hmm. So basically it was, yes, we need to increase safety, and we need to find the best implementation of that, but still the French Quarter has to function.
And you're saying the Royal Street Pedestrian Mall, just so I got you right, runs from where to where?
I was saying it starts at Orleans Avenue and it heads upriver. I don't know where the final barricade is, but it's heading towards Canal. But usually about five blocks of Royal Street from 11 to 4 p.m. daily, maybe even longer hours on the weekends, are closed to vehicular traffic.
I had no idea. You taught me something. All right, we'll take a break, pick it up when we come back. Talking to Aaron Holmes, our friend, executive director of the Vieux-Carré Property Owners, Residents, and Associates, talking about some of the proposals that have been made. We'll also talk about the Teneo proposal when that's expected. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, on his Tuesday morning, April 1st, back with Aaron Holmes, executive director of the Vieux-Carré Property Owners, Residents, and Associates. Aaron, I'm just going back to my April Fool's joke that I pulled and you said, and I quote, "Wow, that's terrible."
Maybe that was a little harsh.
No. I don't think it was harsh at all. I think I deserved it, and it just brought back all the memories of making my mom cry and being stupid. Somebody texted and said that Royal Street is closed between Conti and Orleans. That is, as it stands now, a pedestrian mall between when and when?
I want to say 11 to 4 p.m., but
and the concern,
you know, there's always room for error.
And the concern was that if Bourbon Street should become a pedestrian mall, that they would have to open Royal Street because otherwise that would be too much pedestrian mall?
I think so. But again, I said that was an unverified rumor, but it definitely mobilized individuals that, you know, perform on that strip or businesses on that strip to come out and make their voices heard.
So do we know when the report from Teneo is going to be released? And then what happens from that point?
No, we don't know when it's going to be released. That's really a timetable that's up to the administration and NOPD. But I think the big question is what then? You know, so we're going to get a set of recommendations that the city leaders can choose some or all of. But then there's going to be a process of how to implement. So I spoke about the two pedestrian malls, Bourbon Street and Royal. Those were created through a city council ordinance. And so if they're going to be amended, it has to go through the city council. And we've heard from the administration that that she can implement things through her various administrative departments, but then there's also NOPD. But I think that nothing's going to change overnight, because if you look at other cities that have done major pedestrianization projects, it takes a lot of resources, it takes a lot of logistics for implementation, it takes money, and it takes time. So what I think we have right now, which are temporary barricades that are on loan to NOPD, you know, we're going to look to see how do we harden or make those barricades a little bit more permanent, but nothing's going to happen overnight. It's just, it's too much resource management. So I think it's very clear that we are not going to get the level of personnel security that we've had for the past couple of months. So we are going to need to implement something that doesn't require that manpower, but how it's going to work and how long it's going to take remain up in the air.
Give me a snapshot of today and a quarter as opposed to January 2nd and a quarter.
Well, we're gearing up for festival season. So January 2nd and the quarter was, it was a pretty terrible time to be in the quarter. It was a lot of trying to wrap our heads around what had happened and what the aftermath could be. We, even on the second, we didn't know if there were additional planted explosive devices. So that was a terrifying time. Fast forward to today, I think that residents and businesses are trying to get back in action. You know, we've been through an epic snowstorm, a Super Bowl, we've been through Mardi Gras. We're looking for a little normal day-to-day, but going into festival season, hoping that we are going to get the level of business, especially to our small businesses in the French Quarter. And, of course, we're getting some nice weather now. So it's pretty nice in the French Quarter right now, but you can definitely still see the evidence of the terrorist attack from the first.
I appreciate your time. I really do, Jamie, and I hope you, Aaron, rather, and I hope you come back and talk to us after the report comes out, and we'll see where we stand.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Aaron Holmes, Executive Director of the View Cray Property Owners, Residents, and Associates. Speaking of Jamie, we'll talk to Jamie Rowan when we come back about President Trump's executive orders. Right now, time for WWL First News. 743, 17 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, on this April Fool's Day. Talking to our friend Jamie Rowan, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. Good morning, Jamie. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. Well, thank you.
Would you please clear it up for me? Is it Rowan or Rowan? I want to make sure I get it right.
Rowan.
Okay, like Rowan and Martin, but you're too young to remember that, but I will. Let's talk about, first of all, because I know people are going to get all fed up and riled up and worked up, so let's talk about the history of executive orders and presidents through the years and timelines and all that kind of stuff to give us some context, okay?
Sure. So we talked about executive orders because there's various ways in which the government engages in lawmaking. One way is when the executive branch says there is something that needs to be done, and it's usually related to its own branch's power, which is supposed to be national security. And so if you're in war, you issue an executive order because there isn't time to go through the legislative branch. So the president that made the most executive orders was Franklin Roosevelt during World War II. Aside from him, most executive orders have come at the end of an attempt to use the legislative branch to make law, and where the executive says it's not happening and we need to do something that's within my executive authority, like with immigration. That's an example of where the executive branch may say, I have authority over immigration. I want to do something about that. In the case of Joe Biden, for example, he used the executive authority to bypass legislative gridlock over student debt relief. The thing about executive authority and using an executive order is that it has to be in line with the Constitution. And if it's not, then there has to be an opportunity to challenge the executive order in court.
Let me jump in, if I can, Jamie, for a second and ask, what does the Constitution say about executive orders? Does it address it?
No. But the Constitution is a very bare-bones instrument. It basically says there are three branches of government, and each branch of government has a designated role to play. The executive is supposed to faithfully execute laws that are passed by the legislative branch. And the legislative branch is supposed to pass most of the laws because it is the most representative body. So when our founders were interested in democracy and making sure everybody in the country that at the time could vote had a voice in government, it vested most powers in the legislative branch and Congress. The executive branch is supposed to just execute those laws.
So how did the executive order come to be? Did one president say, you know what? Here's the deal. You're not going to get it done. I'm going to issue an executive order, and then let's see what happens. I'm serious about that. I'm curious.
Yeah, so I think what happened was at a certain point, you look at the Constitution, and the branches of government say, what is within my authority? And so a president said, I am going to promulgate a law. I am going to make a law, and just issued it. And that was okay. And so that's been happening again. Like I said, it started during war times. It started, this type of lawmaking is not new. Mm-hmm. And again, though, it's not new. It's not particularly novel. But it was always within, or it has mostly been, within the scope of what the executive branch is supposed to make executive orders on, which I said is national security, because that is the main area of executive authority in the country.
At what point did there begin to be executive order creep, where it led from in times of war or in national order for national security?
So I would say that practice of using executive orders has really exploded in the past 30 years. And I think when you look at President Clinton, when he came to power, he was coming to power after a 30-year spell of all of the branches of government being within the Democratic Party. And then during the midterms for President Clinton in 94, Newt Gingrich and the Contract on America took over, and there you now had a split branch. You had an executive that was Democratic, and you had a legislative branch that was Republican. And that Republican legislative branch didn't want to pass laws that were aligned with President Clinton's interests. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, you start to see, okay, what is the opportunity for an executive to pass laws that the legislative branch of government isn't supportive of?
So when, real quick, and one more question about context before we move on to current day, when it comes to Congress, is it about Congress politically not wanting to pass a law and forcing the president to veto it if he doesn't like it, concerned with not having enough votes to override a veto? Or is it about there are some situations that are so divisive that they don't want to affect or anger the folks back home, so they just abdicate the authority and say, you know what, we're going to do anything. And with that vacuum existing, the sitting president, whomever it happens to be, says, okay, I'll take care of it. Thoughts?
So one thing that we didn't mention that's really important is that executive orders have grown with the growth of the administrative state. And that, again, is something that came about during the 40s, where it appeared that there were issues that were concerning Americans, that the setup of the Constitution was not allowing for good implementation. So if the federal government is interested in addressing the economy, where in the Constitution does it allow it to do that? And so the federal government started creating agencies. The thing about these agencies is that Congress creates them, but the executive branch administers them. And this is where it gets confusing. The executive branch, the executive then makes executive orders that are targeted at those administrative agencies. And so when an administrative agency is not making rules effectively, the executive might just say, here's the rule that we want to pass. And when what happens is that Congress is basically not passing a lot of laws. And that has been going on for decades now. Congress is a bit gridlocked. And so because the executive agencies are working from older laws passed by Congress, the executive branch is stepping in and saying, well, look, Congress isn't changing the rules. I'm going to go ahead and change the rules.
Now, when you say effective laws, that's a subjective term, right? Let's pick it up there when we come back, and we'll talk about what's going on with President Trump and with former President Biden, all that stuff with Jamie Rowan when we come back. Our friend, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst, Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. I've been talking about executive orders for about 15 years, and that's the best explanation I have ever heard of it. Thank you, Jamie. 751 now, traffic, WWL. Sam 55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker talking to Jamie Rowan on WWL, Associate Professor, Legal Studies, UMass Amherst, and Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. We've already given you the background on history and executive orders. Jamie, what is different about the executive orders that President Trump is issuing?
These are really different than what has happened in the past. And so, again, there's not an increase. There is an increase in number. Trump has issued the most executive orders in his first days of office than other presidents. But the content of these executive orders is really different. So typically when an executive order is made, it states where in the Constitution or in legislation the president gets the authority to make the order. It roots it in existing law. And so presidents before Trump were very careful to make sure that their executive orders would withstand a judicial challenge. Any law, whether by the legislative branch or the executive branch, is subject to judicial review. The court can look at it and say, this law goes against the Constitution. Mm-hmm. What Trump is doing is he is not saying where the power of his executive authority comes from. He's not saying that he actually even has the constitutional authority to make these rules. Moreover, several of these executive orders are directly in contrast to what the Constitution allows. The most blatant of these are the executive orders that are targeting law firms, for example. These executive orders go against the First Amendment, which protects first speech and association, and they also go against the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment, which provide due process, because it's basically saying individuals that want to have lawyers represent them cannot have those lawyers represent them. And it's against the First Amendment because it is saying that lawyers that have represented clients that have causes the president doesn't like are going to be financially harmed to the point that they might not be able to work anymore. And so that is really different. And that is why conservative lawyers are saying this has so outside the bounds of the Constitution that they're challenging those executive orders in court. The thing that's complicated and what the listeners should recognize is that even if you can challenge an executive order in court, the fact that the executive order was made is very damaging. It's like a prosecutor who is threatening lawsuits against people who he knows is innocent. Those innocent people may be able to defend themselves in court, but the cost of defending themselves in court is very high. And so just the act is doing damage.
So it's kind of like suing somebody, and I'm just going to make a, boy, this could be maybe a terrible analogy, Jamie, but once the president, any president, issues an executive order, then it's like, all right, this is the law unless you have the means or the wherewithal to challenge me in court to prove that it isn't?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
But in addition to that, even if you do have the means, as these law firms do, it still is doing damage in the interim because you're scaring off potential clients, right? And the interesting thing about the law firms, and this is why I think it's important to pay attention to them, is that these law firms are not partisan. These law firms are representing people from across the political spectrum. They don't have political identities. And that's really what's scary.
It's the interim that is the problem. Jamie, you have to come back and talk more about this. Jamie Rowan, I'm sorry, Associate Professor of Legal Studies at UMass Amherst and Director of the Center for Justice, Law, and Societies. I think a lot of this could be cleared up if Congress were to do its job, but everybody there is a little bit more concerned about getting reelected than they are with the country. At least that's my opinion. We'll talk about the election over the weekend. We come back with Pearson Cross, a political scientist at ULM.